Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Man in America. I'm your host, Seth Holhouse. So I'm sure a lot of you have already watched Died Suddenly, and if you haven't, I highly recommend it. It's gone, I'd probably say, more than viral with over 5 million views in the past couple of days since it's been released. And the reason why this is such an important documentary is that it ties together a lot of the suspicions and information that all of us have been finding, you know, and asking the question, is the vaccine bad? What's it going to do to people? How's it going to affect birth rates? What's this look like for the future of humanity? And this is where my mind went after watching the documentary is, how is this going to change the course of humankind? Because if some of the figures and numbers that I'm hearing out there are correct, even looking at birth rates, what's our human race look like in a few decades? It's significant. The fabric of our society is going to change because of this bioweapon. And there's no way to look around the other way. There's no other way to frame it. And so to look at this even further, I am having on Dr. David Martin, someone who's been following and tracking everything to do with the COVID pandemic and much, much more. But also he has a very particular mind for analyzing numbers and information and extrapolating data to take a look at what is going to change in our world. And so David and I are going to sit down and have a really honest and open discussion about what's going to happen in our world and how we can prepare for what's coming. But before we get started, folks, make sure you're following me on Telegram, Truth Social, and Gab at Man in America. You can also catch every episode as a podcast if you just want to listen. The links to my podcast and social media are all in the description below. Or just search for Man in America in your favorite podcast app. Make sure you leave me a 5-star rating. It really helps me to reach more people. Also, folks, food prices are going up, energy prices are going up, gas prices are going up, and inflation's not going away anytime soon. Right now, the real rate of inflation is closer to 25%, not the 8% the White House wants you to believe. You can see this with your own eyes and in your own wallet. What this means is that if you had $100,000 in your savings account just 1 year ago, today it's only worth about $75,000 in terms of your actual buying power. Your money is losing value by the day. But if you went back to 1920 and you had a $20 bill or a 1-ounce coin of gold, you could walk into a men's clothing store and buy an entire suit, jacket, shoes, pants, belt, everything. But think about it. What would a $20 bill buy you today? Some socks? But an ounce of gold will still buy you that same suit. And that's why I believe that now, more than ever, it's a good time to consider transferring at least some of your wealth into physical gold and silver. These are real-world assets that have stood the test of time. And for this, I'm so confident in recommending Dr. Kirk Elliott. Kirk has 2 PhDs and is an incredible Christian patriot who's dedicated to helping you break free from the trap of inflation. You can buy gold and silver directly, even in small amounts, or you can transfer your IRA into physical gold and silver with zero taxes or penalties. Kirk Elliott is who I use, he's who my family and my friends use, and he's someone who I trust completely. And look, folks, when it comes to your wealth, you need someone you can trust. So to learn more, open up a new tab right now and go to goldwithseth.com or call 720-605-3900 to speak to a real person right now. Kirk Elliott's team of really skilled advisors will answer all of your questions and take care of you every step of the way. Again, that's 720-605-3900 or goldwithseth.com. All right, folks, let's get started with this interview. I am so pleased to have Dr. David Martin joining me. Dr. Martin, it's so great to have you here again. Thank you so much for being here today.
As always, Seth, it is a joy to speak with you. I enjoy our time together in person and online. It's phenomenal to be with you.
It really is. It really is. So a lot has transpired, you know, since we last talked. And you know, one thing that I want to get into today is looking at this, you know, kind of an analysis of the Died Suddenly documentary, which I want to give just a big kudos to Stu Peters and his team because, well, A, their marketing and their production, you know, the videos, I mean, I think it's reaching 5 million views on Rumble in a couple of days, which is incredible.
Yeah.
But their ability to tie all the information together, I think that people that have been denying the real effects of the vaccine for a long time, it would be very hard for someone to watch that and to still come out and say, you know what, it's still safe and effective.
Yeah. Well, remember, Seth, that you know, Stu has been a stalwart in this fight, and I love him. I love the interactions that I've had with him. It's been a delight to be in a number of both in-person and virtual interactions with him. And the way in which he packages information, the way in which he is thoughtful and spends enough time in inquiry to help walk you into the reality that is transpiring around, is actually a real unique gift. And I acknowledge how amazing and talented he is in that capacity. I just have a huge amount of respect for him. And I think one of the things, as you know, one of the things I get roundly criticized for is I sometimes am a little too technical and a little too geeky. And I love how Stu can take the content that he's covering and turn it into something that really anybody can watch and consume. However, I think it is important to point out that what he's doing is he's putting a very interesting time marker into our public consciousness. I think that film, when it came out, becomes exceptionally important for a bunch of reasons, but probably leading among them is several months ago, I spoke about the fact that the estimated numbers of people who allegedly were going to be erased by virtue of the various vaccination programs, using Bill Gates' own estimates, was that somehow or another we would get a roughly 10% population reduction in the world with the use of vaccines. Now, what he argues and what the fact checkers have argued post that quote is that what he really meant was that when people have a better standard of health living, that there would be fewer births. That's allegedly the argument that was made. But I just made the simple mathematic calculation that said that at the time that statement was made, that talked about the eradication of 700 million people. And people obviously jumped on the number and said, Dave Martin says there's going to be 700 million people dead. And the fact of the matter is that is, number one, not what I said. What I said was their own estimate was a 10% reduction in the world population. The tragedy is I think the number is higher. And I think that wrapping your head around it needs pieces like Died Suddenly, like Stu Peter's work, to help people understand that the rationale behind what I'm talking about is not theoretical. It's actually something that was well documented going all the way back to Ralph Baric's early work, not in humans, but in rabbits. Most people forget what I try to keep reminding people that the very early work of Ralph Baric was to find a way to get coronavirus to target cardiomyopathy. So that's actually infecting and inflaming the heart tissue of rabbits. And that was when coronavirus was largely a consideration only in pigs and dogs. It was actually a youth problem for pigs and dogs. It wasn't a real human problem, and it certainly wasn't a rabbit heart problem. But across 10 years in the 1990s, Ralph Baric was doing work on how to make the spike proteins and other parts of the coronavirus model something that would be much more damaging to heart tissue and to vascular tissue. And so, you know, we realized that this was something that was architected. My gosh, you know, 1998 is when Anthony Fauci found it and decided to run with it. So that's 24 years of premeditated work on targeting the vascular system and the heart. And I think that if people pay attention to the fact that Anthony Fauci and Ralph Baric collaborated specifically on this gain of function research, then Stu's film isn't a reach. It's a very interesting, foreboding harbinger of things to come.
Yeah, I think especially if you look at the way it's changing birth rates, and that was alarming data, because I think there's twofold to this, because I think that now it's no longer a conspiracy theory that they're talking about depopulating the world.
Right.
And that, you know, that their models have shown, you know, going back to the Club of Rome and the work they've done, that, you know, basically that, well, if we don't wipe out a large portion of the world's population, then we're all done for. And so they're looking at it saying, well, you know, we're doing everybody a favor by kind of taking out some portion of the population. But there's, when I say it's twofold, one is the people that got the vaccine that will die prematurely, that won't live to their true life's potential. But right. The other is the reduction in birth rates, whether it's in infertility in males, whether it's miscarriages in women, stillbirths. And in my opinion, that's the more frightening thing. Because, say you took out half of the world's population today, well, if the birth rates if people can still reproduce, then we can get back up to that. But if people lose the ability to reproduce healthy and create healthy children, what's that do for the future of humanity? And that's to me, that's the big question here.
Well, and that's why I said the number is actually an underestimation. I mean, 10% of people dying, prematurely is a $700 million person question. But to your point, as we already have seen, and by the way, we saw this before we saw the introduction of biological weapons. We saw this actually as a naturally occurring phenomenon in Japan, where what we observed was that the social pressures on individuals in Japan led to a negative population growth rate that included premature and normal term deaths, but also just a decrease in the reproduction of the population. And it's an existential crisis for Japan as we speak. In China, we saw the one-child policy disproportionately lead to too many males, so much so that China was paying other countries to provide visas for males in China to be essentially exported so they could actually be part of a reproductive program somewhere else, because there was not enough female population to match the male population under the one-child policy in China. And that has been and continues to be a significant public policy problem for China. But what we have now on a global scale, and Australia's numbers are almost incredulous. I'm not sure that I would even recite the official statistics coming out of Australia right now, but we're seeing massive drop-offs in the birth rate.
And the question said 70% reduction in birth rate. That was the figure presented in
Dyson. Oh, and those numbers are coming from official sources. Now, the question that obviously is worth noting is that Australia had some of the most draconian lockdown measures that we've seen anywhere in the world. And the government of Australia really went full tyrannical against its population with limitations on how far people could travel, with all sorts of restrictions on interstate travel and on even within your own town or your own village travel. So there is a practical reality that quite literally people were not getting together physically. And as a result, we could ascribe some of that to lockdowns. But the rate at which it's declining is not only because people weren't finding each other. As crazy as it sounds, sex has a way of happening. It's one of those things where lockdown or no lockdown, people find each other. And so the challenge that we have in that data is that the dramatic nature of the decline is shocking. And if you look at the United States data in hospitals, we see these very bizarre new terms coming in where stillbirths aren't being called stillbirths. They're being called a number of other things, but there's a very, very large increase in near to full term pregnancies that are actually coming to a termination. And they're coming up with all kinds of new terminology associated with that. But the increases in some cities and towns are going up by 22, 23, 24% on a quarterly basis. And that's just mind-boggling. And when you think about the combination of these effects, the death rates that are coming off of the injections, and then the fertility and miscarriage problems coming off of people exposed to the spike protein. And the fact of the matter is, this is a much more catastrophic event than my very heretical and apparently very disruptive comment was several months ago. So, but I do think, coming back to Stu's movie, I think the value of having this conversation and the value of showing people the pathology you know, the very graphic, and they're disturbing. I would certainly encourage people to think twice about the timing of when they watch the film. But when you see these clots being pulled out, you don't unsee those things. It's not an unseeable thing. And when you see the vast majority of people who don't have one or two, but these are multiple in a single person, it is no surprise at all that we're dealing with a situation where a lot of people's lives have been shortened catastrophically. And I think, as I've said in numerous settings lately, I think as a society, we have a very interesting muscle that has atrophied for many, many generations, which is the muscle of understanding how to deal with mass grief.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm not sure that we're very good at that as a society. And I'm pretty sure that that's something that we really need to be talking about, because we're going to have to encounter how to deal not only with mass grief, but grief coming from the loss of people who may have been very controversial, may have been very outspoken, and in certain instances may have said very terrible things about you. You know, can you genuinely get to a place of accessing empathy for those who've spoken ill of you? That's going to be a question that a lot of us are going to have to face.
I certainly agree with that. And I think that that's something that you're right. I mean, really, when was the last time that we had a true mass casualty event? I mean, look, we lost a couple thousand people in 9/11 time. And that turned the entire nation upside down I think there's a lot of agenda behind that. And they wanted the entire nation to be turned upside down. And it was a very disturbing psychological event for people that,
right.
Paved the way for the Patriot Act and other things that came, shortly following. But this is something that you're right. We haven't, the generations that are alive right now, we haven't really experienced this. I mean,
no.
And I would say humanity's never experienced something like this. And maybe
certainly
back
not at this scale.
The days of the Noah's flood, perhaps, right?
Yeah. Well, we can look at the Cultural Revolution in China. We can look at the Stalin era in Russia. And the truth is, no one will ever know the death counts that are truly there, because there was no genuine reporting mechanism to ever understand the scale of those. There are people who put the scale of those deaths somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 million people in the combined of the Stalin era pogroms and the Chinese Cultural Revolution. But we're talking about at least 10 times that number. And that's without question. I mean, no one would dispute that combined the Second World War, the Cultural Revolution, and the Stalin era, as a combined force, they still, as a combined death count, are 1/10 of what we're talking about. So to say we don't have the emotional or social memory or skill set to deal with the scale of this is the understatement. And if you look at what's become of Russia and China as a result of these things, the autocratic governments that have come into power are on the back of mass exterminations. Yeah. That's how they gave rise to power. So this is not an accidental thing where we have an event and then suddenly, people come to their better senses. It actually goes the wrong way. And historically, that's why I'm saying that the conversation needs to be had now, so that we start changing the inflection of previous experiences, because in every single experience that's happened before, what follows is more autocratic, more draconian, and more tyrannical than what came prior to it. And that's a pretty ominous sign.
It is. It is. So just in terms of, I know this is, it's such a hard thing to nail down, but with looking at the side effects or the effects of the vaccine, which I think that, in the documentary, they said we're over, I think, 12 billion doses delivered. And yeah. I forget the exact number, the exact portion of the population that's received at least one vaccine, but it's well into the billions.
Yeah.
And so based on some of the research that you've done, how many, and this is a hard number to put forward, but how many do you think of these people will live past 5 or 10 years? I mean, what is the rate of death looking like from your perspective and your research?
Well, you have to start cobbling together some interesting numbers. And anytime you do that, I caution people. One of the things you learn in statistics is every time you compound a thing that's an estimate, you also compound the error that is in the estimate. So it's kind of an ominous warning to people who derive too much. But if we were to take, for the sake of this argument, that we have roughly 3.5 to 4 billion people who have been injected. And of that population, certainly it's reasonable to say that we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 billion of the mRNA injections. And the reason why those are important and distinct is that that's what turns your body into what I refer to as the bioweapons factory. Why do I refer to it that way? Because legally that's what it is. When you actually create a thing that manufactures a known pathogen, that is actually a biological weapon manufacturing. And the fact that your body is doing it means you're a bioweapons factory. That's just the nature of the beast. If you don't like it, you have to go change the laws because that's the law. Now, the fact that we've turned 3 billion people into a bioweapons factory is without question a fundamental existential problem with humanity. That means that we have mRNA and we have DNA modifications that are going to not only impact this generation, but it will impact generations to come. There is no question about that whatsoever. And everybody who wants to hide behind the CDC's nonsense that there's no way that mRNA could write into DNA, you have to go back and you have to look at the 10-year National Science Foundation grant that gave rise to the company that we now know as Moderna, because the entire existential reason for that company was to get mRNA to write to DNA. That's why they built the company. So anybody who wants to sit back and pretend like this is some sort of innocuous thing and it clears out and it doesn't have any long effects is absolutely ludicrous and is denying, are you ready for this? The scientific evidence. So follow the science. It gets you to what I just said. Now, if we start with the number 3 billion, and then we start looking at what were these problematic lot and batches, which is the way I've looked at this thing from the standpoint of the way I look at the world, because I look at the world through the lens of risk management and risk transfer. Most people don't know that my corporation is involved in risk management. We happen to do financial risk management, but we are very intimately involved in the broader sector of what we think of as actuarial sciences that give rise to insurance. And so what I've been doing is I've been looking at that number and then looking at the number of lots that were associated with extremely high adverse events. And Seth, you know that there's been a lot of conversation about the fact that there are certain batches that had high degrees of problematic adverse events and certain batches that seem to have no effect at all. If you look at the number of problematic batches, you're talking about 7 to 15%, somewhere in that range of all the batches are the ones that had extremely severe adverse events. So now what we're talking about is we're talking on the best case, and I want you to hear the words I just said, on the best case, we're talking about permanent death and disability to 300 million people. That is the best case. That is the entire population of the United States distributed across the world. That is the number we're talking about. And that's the best case. Now, let's put that into context. When we think about what this means, and Seth, I know that you're at an age, I know I'm at an age where we understand the challenges of aging parents and friends with aging parents and the amount of care that is required to deal with people who are suffering from long-term effects of stroke, of disability, of paralysis, of neurologic degenerative problems, of Alzheimer's, of all sorts of other neurologic disorders. What we know is that this 300 million people takes out another 300 or more million people. That's because caretakers and these are people who will not be able to be part of the contributing economy. They're not going to be able to be doing the things that they have historically done because they will be, in fact, involved in the near 24/7 care of the individuals who are actually in that other 300 million. So we're talking about 600 million people incapacitated. And then we look at things like the CMS mandate, which, as you know, I litigated in federal court in Utah, making the argument that it was an illegal Federal Trade Commission Act violation to call these things vaccinations because they aren't. They're gene therapies. That's what how they were characterized by the FDA and by the CDC prior to April 20 of 2020. You know, the fact of the matter is we are living in a world where we know that the caregivers who are the ones trained to deal with this are among the ones who are most likely to suffer from the casualty effects. So now we have another problem. I don't know how often, Seth, you've had the privilege of, I don't know, cleaning somebody's bedpan or helping somebody get to a toilet when they're disabled.
I can tell you
for all of the people who are out there sitting there going, well, somebody else is going to have to do that. Well, the answer is the somebody else is actually going to be you. And that's where I'm talking about this challenge that I think many of us are going to have to come head to head with, which is, are you capable of caring for somebody who yelled at you to put your mask on, who refused to let you come to a family reunion because you didn't take the kill shot? Are you willing to love the person who actually made your life during the last 2 or 3 years a living hell? And I'll tell you, that's going to take some deep, deep introspection, some really, really massive amounts of grace and mercy. And I am not sure that most of us are prepared for what we're going to have to face. So best case scenario, Seth, we're talking about the incapacitation of 600 million people. That's the best case.
What's the worst case look like?
Well, the worst case is 3 billion plus, because remember that the 3 billion, where we have the mRNA floating around, as with this horrible idea called CRISPR, which is the gene editing technology that was initiated during the pandemic so that nobody paid attention to even a worse problem being introduced into the world. For those of you who are not familiar, the palindromic repeat splicing of genes, which is where you take little segments of genes and you cut them in or cut them out of the genome. The problem with CRISPR has always been the idea that editing a genome is something that we can do, and all we're going to do is target the thing that we're going after. The problem, and this is a problem I've talked about from the very beginning, is that DNA does not exist in nature. DNA is a model of a destructive process of taking apart chromosomes. And chromosomes, which do exist in nature, are wound up versions of the molecules that we describe as DNA. But here's the problem. Those molecules fold on each other. And while biotech currently tells us that the only information that ever happens is contained in the chemistry of the strands, there is an enormous amount of evidence that shows that chromosomes have an effect in their wound coiled structure. So I might take out a snippet here and there of a DNA strand, and I might be able to take out a little bit of a gene expression here or there. But what I don't know is in the living system, what happens in the folds of the DNA in the chromosomes. I have no idea what happens there. And the problem that that presents is that every time humans have decided to simplify a model of the complex nature of human life down to a two-dimensional model, and then started messing with the two-dimensional model, every single time this has ever happened in human history, and I mean every time with no exception, we wind up creating something far worse than the thing we were trying to solve. So what my concern is that we now have a world in which, according to the FDA's most recent standards, we are now going to allow RNA technology to be injected into livestock. We are going to allow RNA technology to be injected into or introduced into other forms of the food supply. And not unlike what we've seen with now over 50% of the population have a gastrointestinal problems because of our gene therapies in plants and crops, we're talking about a world in which, through the combined effect of what we allowed to be introduced in this mRNA model, during the COVID outbreak. We are actually talking about a population where clearly at this point in time, 3/4 of the world's population is going to be directly impacted by the mRNA modified meats, foods, and otherwise that we are going to actually have exposed to us. And so the likelihood that over the next 3 to 5 years, you can safely go to a fast food restaurant or any restaurant for that matter in America is near zero. Because yes, you'll be able to drive up to the Chick-fil-A and it's 10 wide, you know, drive-through lanes will be all open, but the chicken you're eating ain't going to be chicken. It's going to be Franken chicken. And we have no idea what the implications of that are, but all I know is that the Japanese at the turn of the last century knew that by introducing Bacillus thuringiensis into food, they knew that it disrupted the GI systems of every person. And for the last 25 years, we have had a wholesale adoption of Bacillus thuringiensis BT in every single cereal grain and every single grain that we produce in America. So your corn, your cotton, your wheat, your soybeans, every single one of those is actually what you thought was food. But it's the introduction of a known biological weapon that in the early 1900s, I mean 1902, 1903, 1904, Japan realized was a biological weapon. That's ubiquitous in our food supply. And now, Seth, how many people have GI problems? How many people have irritable bowel syndrome? How many people have all kinds of problems with food allergies? And how many of those are directly result a known introduction of a biological weapon by a company called DuPont, by a company called Monsanto, by a company called Bayer? How many of those are the point? And here's the reason I'm making that association. We're talking in this particular instance of something far more egregious than Bacillus thuringiensis. You know, BT as a bacteria, which is how we do gene therapies on crops. BT crops are dangerous. We know that they're dangerous. We know they have been dangerous for a long time. What we're talking about with the introduction of mRNA into the actual protein that we take into our bodies is far more egregious than anything that BT could have ever done. So where does that put us? That puts us at a population where 70 to 80% of the world's population is now going to be exposed to genetically modified known pathogenicity. And that's going to be what we're looking at in the next 5 years.
It's a lot to take in. And you know, going back to just, you know, some of the earlier points, like if you combine all this together and you look at the just the overall health, and we're not even getting into a lot of the other things that, you know, going into chemicals in the skies, I mean,
right,
you know, the poisoning of our water sources, I mean, radiation from 5G. I mean, there's like an infinite number of other things that could affect this. But I mean, even looking at what you just mentioned there, combined with the falling birth rates. I mean, if you had to say, let's just fast forward to 50 years. And the reason why I'm asking this particular question is because I want to then circle back to the question about preparing for what life is going to be like in the next decade, 2 decades,
yeah,
3 decades, because we have to be extremely sober about what our future looks like, because I think that that's how you prepare. And all the people that just want to bury it and put their heads in the sand and don't want to face these facts, well, A, they're probably the ones that are on their third or fourth booster because they don't want to actually look outside,
right,
of the, you know, what the main narrative is. But people are not going to be prepared for this. So if you look forward, say, let's say, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, how do the actions that are unfolding right now affect the trajectory of our human population by then? Whereas right now we're right around 8 billion.
Yeah. So, left, you'll recall in Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, there's a beautiful moment where there's the ghost of Christmas future that takes Scrooge to the gravesite. And they have a very ominous moment where the ghost points to the gravestone and there's Scrooge's grave. And then, you know, the ghost shows him how miserable his life was and how miserable in death his memory will be. And there's a very poignant moment in that story where Scrooge asks of the ghost, are these the events that must be, or are they the events that will happen if things remain unaltered? And it's a really beautiful question, right? It's the question that I think many of us should ask every day. Is this the way it has to be, or is this what happens if I do nothing? So let's do the do nothing scenario. As you know, in my most recent film, American Revolution, one of the points that I make is that by 2035, 2037, somewhere in that range, officially statistics-wise, the Social Security Administration runs out of money. And by running out of money, I mean goes to zero. Now, the fact of the matter is that film and that content was shot in 2016 prior to the 4 years that followed of Fed interventions, which took the interest rates down even further, which ultimately leads to that date being closer to 2028. So somewhere between, let's say, 2028 and 2035, Social Security, as we know it, ceases to exist. That means everybody over the age of 65 at that point in time has no ability to have a safety net. And that does not just mean you don't get your Social Security pension. That means you don't get Medicare and Medicaid, which means you have no way to access health care. That's a pretty ominous thing. We have that within 5 years. So within 5 years, we have the over 65 population that either is going to be dead or they are going to be in a condition where their ability to maintain a quality of life is going to be severely compromised. Let's put a number on that. By then, it'll be 86 million people. 86 million people will not have the resources they need to actually maintain their life. And if 86 million people don't have those resources, then those people are going to have a number of catastrophic events, and those are going to be all sorts of things. And by the way, we know that it's coming. This is not a theoretical. There's zero probability in what I'm saying. There's 100% certainty in what I'm saying. And that's a weird thing to be able to say, but it's very rare. But sometimes you can actually look into a future and go, there's a cliff. If I keep accelerating for that cliff, there's a point in time where I'm going to hit the edge of the cliff and I'm going to go over. That's what happens if no intervention is done. And that means that we have, in the first instance, a very large casualty among our aging population. But we also have something happening at the same time, which is, as you know, generational wealth transfer is a very interesting problem here in America. It's a problem a lot of places around the world, but it's a real big problem here in America. And we have to ask ourselves a question. What would happen, I don't know, if you were a government that was illiquid, which our government is, and you suddenly need to manifest an enormous amount of resources, wouldn't it be fascinating to be able to do something very cunning, have an enormously high death rate among the over 65 population, and simultaneously change estate laws and tax laws so that you do what? You basically confiscate the country. Now, I don't think that's a theoretical low probability. I think that's a mid-range probability that we have a world in which the government changes significantly estate and inheritance laws and taxes so that it becomes extremely hard for working class Americans to actually do wealth transfer in this country. And I think that that is a high probability, not a mid or low probability. And I would advise people to watch in Congress, in this next Congress that's just being seated. Watch how many introductions of changes to inheritance tax are going to be introduced. And I can guarantee you they're going to be on the docket. So pay attention, because you heard it here before it was news. And I can guarantee you it's going to be news. But then what happens is if we go down the road and we start looking at these numbers, Seth, and we start looking at things like what, you know, Stu talked about in Died Suddenly. If you think about what I've talked about in American Revolution, what you find is that the resources required, the financial resources required to recover what we've lost, do not exist here in this country. Virtually all of the wealth of America is now in British domiciled bank accounts. which means we do not have an ability to nationalize assets the way other countries in other situations like this have nationalized assets, because they're literally not here. So where Venezuela or Brazil or Argentina or Uruguay can actually just go, well, the state's going to take everything. Bad news is the state can't take everything here because most of our assets aren't here. So you can't nationalize this country, which means the only way you can nationalize anything is to take property rights from people. That's the only way to do it. And what that does in this country is a very sobering reality, because I think that what could very easily come out of the next 5 to 10 years is, I think, left to their own devices, a government could turn against the people, and the people could turn against the government. And I know that people sit there all the time going, well, are you saying there's going to be a civil war? Are you going to say there's going to be this or that, the other thing? The fact of the matter is, our history shows us that in times like this, conflict has historically been where we've turned. Being very precise about what I'm saying is not an advocacy for anything. This is an advocacy for thoughtful dialogue that says, left to our own devices, our record sucks. Okay, so the only way to change that is to actually acknowledge A, that there's a problem, B, that our historical behaviors around those problems haven't been good, and C, we need to have a different conversation now. Because if we wait for the event horizon to emerge, then what we're going to add to the already death and destruction we have from the biological weapons that we have circulating in people's bloodstreams right now, we also have armed conflict in this country. And I can tell you, you know, you can go back and look at the Civil War and you can look at what the effects were then. You can go back and look at what's happened with other internal conflicts, whether you want to historically look at things like the French Revolution. You want to look at the War of the States that was the 100-year war in Europe. What I do know is that we have this wild card of violence, which when people see themselves as hopeless and see themselves as living in a system that does not care for them, then the result that includes turning to violence is all too often the reflex that people turn to. And I think that is the ultimate wild card when you ask the question of 2050, because I think punctuated by an armed conflict, we could see a diminution of this country that is actually something we've not seen and contemplated ever before. And I do think that the risk is very high. And I think the risk is high for a bunch of reasons, but I'll tell you where it is for me the highest. There's no question that the judiciary in the United States has decided to abandon the public. And I don't mean that lightly. I mean that courts in this country have decided that they are going to be merely the arbiters of the dogma of the establishment narrative. And if you look, and I did a show on Monday with my wife, Kim, on our Butterfly of the Week show. I did a show on the lawsuit being brought against Eric Napudi in Missouri. What's fascinating about that case is the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, in their announcement in April of 2021 of the case, actually violated the law that they are charging Eric with in their own press release. Not, this is not a close call. This is a, they violated their own law that they're prosecuting a citizen with. They violated it in their press release. And do you realize, Seth, that not a single AG, and by the way, we're talking about Schmidt in Missouri, who allegedly is one of the good guys. Schmidt refuses to actually prosecute the fact that he has a citizen in his state that is currently being threatened and prosecuted by the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice for doing a crime that they committed themselves in the announcement of the case they filed against him. Now, when I say the judiciary is silent, I mean that we don't have people in Missouri, and I'm not talking about a blue state left, you know, New Jersey or New York. I'm talking about Missouri. We don't have people in Missouri who are saying enough. We will not allow the judiciary to be used as an armed component of the social resistance that is destroying this country. And nobody's doing anything. Nobody. And I find that to be appalling. And I find that to be the kind of thing that gives rise to ultimately the futility that often results in conflict.
I think that when people get to a point where there's no other place, there's no other thing they can resort to. And I also, I think that, you know, we've noticed and we've seen statistics on this that since the pandemic started, a number of new gun owners that are liberal leaning and, you know, voting left has been skyrocketing.
Yeah.
They're arming themselves for the very first time. And I think that, you know, if tomorrow, you know, it was on national news that the truth of the vaccine, let's just say that CNN covered died suddenly, hypothetically, right? And they're saying, wow, look at the birth rates, look at the death rates. And, you know, actually, you know, the government was lying to you the whole time. For me, I would just say, yeah, like, I know. But I think there's a lot of the country, they haven't, like, I've spent years building a foundation of knowledge to understand where we're at in history. And that would make sense to me. But there's a large portion of this population, and especially the people that are on their second, third, fourth booster that would see that, they would not know how to react to that. And that's what worries me more than anything. I think that the people
just reinforce exactly what you're saying. Ironically, the mainstream media says that the threat of violence comes from somehow the armed right.
No, we're the
fact of the matter is, go back to Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana and tell me who was shooting at fire trucks and who was shooting at first responders. By the way, it wasn't a bunch of American flag wearing, cowboy hat wearing, boot wearing Texans. It was the Democratic Party's Black Lives Matters crowd that was actually shooting at first responders. And you are pointing to something which is so important that we highlight, because the violent reaction is going to be coming from the people who think they were duped.
Exactly.
And that's not the armed right.
Exactly. And this is what concerns me. And this is just, it's just where my mind goes. This is why I've got, you know, food prepped, and why, you know, I grow a garden, I've got chickens, you know, it's like, this is where my mind goes, because I extrapolate this information and say, okay, what's life going to be like in 5 years? And I need to start taking actions now to make sure that I can protect my family in 5 years.
Yeah.
And, but when I look at these types of scenarios, even looking at the numbers of deaths, I think that we're going to be seeing. I mean, even some of these statistics I'm already seeing right now are pointing towards upwards of 25 million that have already died from the vaccine.
Yeah.
And it could be much more. When we get to a place where, you know, gosh, in 5 years, is it 30 million in America? Is it 100 million? I mean, I don't know. And what is that? It's like the question that I have, what does that look like for our society? Does that mean that you can still go to the grocery store as normal? Can you still, place an order on Amazon? Does a city still have a semblance of order? I mean, this is, and you mentioned the ability to deal with mass grief, which I absolutely agree. I mean, when people, you know, are we going to see bodies just lining the streets because the funeral homes can't keep up? And I mean, is that what this is going to look like? I mean, I don't want to be so kind of black-pilled, as they'd say, or dire in this, but I'm trying to just look at all the data and information that's in front of me and say, look, this is most likely what the future could look like. And how do we prepare for that? I mean, it's...
Seth, I think it's important for people to realize, and I love the nature of this conversation, and I love the tenor of it, because one could sit there and say, well, is this fear-mongering? And the fact of the matter is, no, I haven't changed my conversation since the beginning. I said at the very beginning of this whole pandemic that this was a racketeering crime. Okay? So let's take another racketeering crime. In the 1920s, when a huge amount of the racketeering public awareness was built, it was built around the mafia. Now, it turns out that the graph behind me was the 1913 graph that actually gave rise to most of our racketeering statutes. And that was J.P. Morgan. That is the lovely white-collar criminal that throughout the early 1900s was in control of this country. What's fascinating about this is that in the early days of the pandemic, I said this was a racketeering crime. Now, let's just play the tape forward. If we look at what happened in the 1920s, what happened was we had armed conflict in the streets. And yes, courtesy of Elliot Ness, we all know that that was just the thugs of the Al Capones and the other mobsters and gangsters that were going in doing drive-by shootings. But it wasn't just that. It turns out that an enormous amount of industry was hijacked by things called unions. And those unions became militant. I don't know if you recall, but I certainly remember when Teamsters would shoot at the truckers. And these are armed conflicts that were triggered by what was allegedly labor rights movements and all sorts of other things, but they were thugs. These were people who actually decided that ideology was more important than human life. And I want to be really clear on that. Racketeering always puts an ideology above human life. You are the cost of the process getting done when you die inside of a racketeering case. And that's been the case all along, right? You go back and you look at Morgan and you look at his mining conflicts and you look at the history of the Pinkertons and you look at the mining conflicts of the last century in the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s. Look at all of those cases. Every single one of them, the loss of human life was justified for the greater good. And what we have right now is exactly the same argument being made. You know, by the way, if a pharmaceutical company doesn't like the results of VAERS, it's their problem, not ours, because it turns out that the 1986 Act says that they are responsible to make sure VAERS is accurate. So if it's not accurate, it's their fault, not ours, for using it. But whether we're talking about VAERS, whether we're talking about any of the other reporting systems, every single death and disability has been chalked up as part of the greater good. There is no greater good when you stop caring about humanity. And there is no caring about humanity that is going to be something that survives a process where we see this kind of mass loss of life and quality of life. It just is not going to happen. And so the importance of a conversation placed exactly where we have this conversation sitting, right after Stu's movie came out, in the context of my movie being shown around the country, these are conversations that we have one massive advantage that previous generations didn't have. And the advantage we have is foresight. We are talking about something we can do something about. So far from being a horrible, depressing black pill conversation, this is the ultimate conversation to be having right now. Because what we need to be doing is we need to be placing into the public conversation issues that we as a public will have to face. And we can do the individual preparation, as you alluded to, which is to make sure you've provided for your family, which is a fabulous idea. Kim and I are deeply committed to doing that for not only our family, but for our greater ecosystem. So we're kind of overkill there because we expect to have people at our house.
Us too.
but you know, what we're doing is we're trying to think about ways in which we not only take care of ourselves, but we're also trying to convene conversations where as a public, we raise our consciousness to the fact that, as I said earlier in this conversation, we are going to have to be the agents of mercy to people who showed us none. And if you haven't prepared for it, you won't be it.
That is the important point. And I think that a lot of this gets back to just what are we doing here as humans? Do we have a soul? Is there a God? These kinds of questions.
Yeah.
Right? They say there's no atheist in a foxhole. When you see death all around you, do you still deny that there's, you know, God? Do you still deny that anything like that exists? And I think that this is what I think that's going to, I feel like what we're witnessing right now in history in so many ways is the separation of the wheat from the chaff. We're seeing the polarization of good and evil become so distinct that there's no middle ground anymore.
That's and exactly
I believe
right.
that when we enter into this kind of a future, there's going to be a lot of people that will become saints. There's going to be a lot of people that will become demons. And there's not going to be a middle ground.
No.
So I think that the best thing that we can do is to say, okay, how can I start really gearing myself up to become a saint in this time? Because that's what's needed in this.
Well, and that's where I encourage people to constantly, I mean, we're having this conversation on the eve of Thanksgiving. And what I love about that is I love the improbability of that. Remember that when Lincoln introduced Thanksgiving, he did it in a war-torn country. He did it in a world where all you saw was blood and death and destruction. That's all you saw. But Lincoln was wise enough to recognize that we needed to institute something in this country to remind us that no matter how desperate and dire the situation became, the overwhelming grace and merciful and bountiful providence that surrounds us is so overwhelming and compelling that no amount of darkness can even put an eclipse on it. And so the fact that we instituted as a country this concept of Thanksgiving and the fact that we decided to do it when we did is so important. This Thanksgiving, we have the ability, like we do every single day, to reflect on the abundant goodness that is showered upon us and actually sit back and say, you know, against the backdrop of that, darkness doesn't have a chance. Now, it does when we decide to give it quarter, when we decide to open ourselves up to being despondent, and we decide to open ourselves up to being felt like this is an overwhelming, unsolvable, right? When that happens, then we're the ones that are the problem. But the minute we actually replace that sense of futility with a sense of gratitude, we're back in the game. And so that's why, you know, I'm a big, big fan of reminding people that, you know, we have what previous generations never had. We have the opportunity to sit in advance of the coming storm and be prepared. And this is no different from Noah and the Ark. It's no different from any of the ancient stories of equal cataclysms. The fact of the matter is we have a chance to stand against this storm and we have a chance to get ready for it. And like Joseph in Egypt, right? We have the fat years right now because the skinny years are coming. And that's okay because we can be prepared. And in that preparation, we can actually start building the human characters that are going to make us more the saint than the demon to which you referred.
Yeah, and it's interesting, actually, because when I booked you to come on, I had no idea what we would talk about. I just felt like I need to have David on it, and there's an important conversation to have. And it's amazing that this is on the eve of Thanksgiving. And you know, it's such an important thing for us to remember. And you know, I've studied a lot of what happens during catastrophe, especially looking into what happens during an EMP, which is one of the most catastrophic things that can happen to a nation. And in reading a lot of the experts talk about this and seeing their perspective of it, you know, one thing that does happen is that it brings people closer together.
Correct.
And I think that's the important thing right now, is that we have to, as one of the things that we're doing to prepare ourselves mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, is bring our families as close as we can get them. And for the people that understand what's happening, even if your family rejects you, and still bring them close, because they can only reject the truth for so long before it's staring them right in the face. And that's when they're going to need us. Like everyone that's watching this right now, everyone that watched Died Suddenly, everyone around us that's mocking us and laughing and looking down on us and you know, kicking us out of the family gatherings, they're going to need us. Yeah. More than we ever thought possible. And we have to be
ready
for
that. That's exactly right.
And I like to say, you know, one perspective is that, to take it a step further, is that God chose us for this. Like, and that's what, like, I really believe. It's like, I don't want to live in any other time in history, but right now, because I feel like I was chosen to be here right now, to be doing exactly what I'm doing, because there will be a great need in the future for people that can be calm and compassionate and that will help, you know, your neighbor, help those that, you know, like really were rude and mean and angry. We have to set aside our own ego and be there for people. And I think that I have a lot of hope in humanity though, because I really believe that right now we don't really know true suffering. And even like, you know, people, when you see an animal suffering or you see a child suffering, if you're a decent person, something changes inside of you. Your heart feels that person. And I think that a lot of people, even right now, that don't think of themselves as compassionate, when they see the real suffering unfolding around them, a different part of them will emerge. And I think it's going to be the better part.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. I think it's the most enlightening and exciting time to be alive. Kim and I recall how much prior to this, we had a number of acquaintances, but since all of the craziness of the past 3 years, we have innumerable friends. The quality of our interactions, as you said earlier, the separation of the wheat and the chaff. I mean, the good news is we don't spend any time guessing. It becomes very evident very fast. And the friendships that we have, I know, are being made manifest tomorrow around our dining room table. We're going to have a bunch of people who are courtesy of COVID, who are part of our life. And you know, our Thanksgiving is going to be one that is very beautiful, very bountiful. And I know for everyone listening to this, I know that the ability we all have to decide what this narrative looks like going forward is entirely, entirely dependent on our ability to participate as agents of mercy and grace in a time where we have received precious little of it. But that's okay. That's why we're here.
Yes, it is. So David, I want to pull up your website where people can follow your work, because you're always doing incredible things. So this is your main site, which is fullylive.world. So it's not fullylivworld.com, it's fullylive.world. And so tell us what you're working on here.
Well, the big thing that we're working on right now is actually part of this conversation. You see right there on the cover, we have the 12 Senses Workshop that we're going to be doing in Boulder, Colorado, January 22 to 26. And that workshop is actually something that was born of the work that Kim and I have been doing for the last several years. The workshop is to rewire all 12 cranial nerves, to get all 12 of your senses back online. And one of the things that most people don't understand is that the value of doing these exercises to make sure that we have all of our capabilities firing is something that's mission critical. And the reason for it is because we've been trained over the last now 8,000 years to have roughly access to what we call 5 senses. But the fact of the matter is our brains were wired with 12. And so we're going to be doing a workshop to bring people back into the active use of all 12 intelligences. And now it's a funny experience when you feel all of your brain turned on. It's actually an amazing experience. And through a 4-day workshop, we're going to be taking people on a journey to reactivate their entire capacity of their entire brain. And we do that using a series of things that you can do at home. We do not mediate it. And this is not, you know, this is not using chemistry or anything else. This is actually using the body that you were born into at its full potential. And the reason why we're doing it is because if we're going to have a conversation about the future of humanity, we need to actually have a good picture of what humanity unconstrained is. And that means getting people to be using all of their brain, all of their mind, all of their heart, all of their senses. And so this upcoming workshop, we've done a couple of them. You know, Seth, one of the fun things is when you feel the created genius that you are, you never go back. Like you said about people uncovering those beautiful traits of kindness and mercy and all of the things that come when we're confronted with challenges. It turns out that when you are fully human, when you have all of your senses active, when you have all of your acuity tuned to its highest level, you're actually a good person.
Yeah.
When you are not living under the narrative that something's wrong, something's broken, you're incapable, you're inadequate, whatever that is, when you are fully you, the vast, vast majority of us are good. And so we are unleashing a whole raft of goodness, and that's what we're going to be doing in January. We're looking forward to it. It's a lot of fun. We have a great time. I always say that it's not for the faint-hearted, because we actually do things to quite literally rewire nerves that haven't fired potentially at all in our adult life. So it's an intrusive, fun, playful experience, and that's our next big thing. We're looking forward to it.
Well, you know, if there's someone that I knew that I would say that, having met you in person and interviewed you a lot, I'd say this guy's using a lot more of his brain than I am. So there's some sort of secret that you've got that perhaps I could benefit from. So
yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I when people say, "Well, how do you do what you do?" My response is, "How don't you?" I don't know how not to, and that's part of the fun. Part of the fun is I have developed the whole curriculum around 12 senses, around my own lived experience. And because of it, I just share it with other people. And it's a beautiful, fun time. You know, the good news is you might not get them all, but if you get twice the number of senses and intelligences you had when you came in, you're still better off.
Oh, absolutely.
Shoot for all 12. If you get 5 or 6 more, you're great.
Exactly. Well, folks, I'll tell you, know, for those of you that are watching or listening, if you've gotten this far into this interview, I congratulate you for sticking around. I think it's a really important discussion, but I'd ask you to share it with at least one or two of your friends, because I think that honestly, right now, the main narrative I'm seeing is look at this information and died suddenly. But I think that has to be followed up with what are we going to do with this information?
And exactly
that's why I think
right.
This conversation really set the stage and the foundation for some of that. And I'll have, you know, of course, you'll be coming back on because we'll continue this conversation.
Looking forward to it, Seth. And between now and then, to you, your family, and all of your listeners, happy Thanksgiving. Be grateful. I know I am, and I know I'm grateful for you. Thank you for what you're doing.
It's so good to have you. Thank you so much, David. Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday, and we'll be in touch.
All right.
Thank
Very
you.
Good.